Welcome to a study of the Book of Ephesians. Our speaker, Dr. Ken Boa, is president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today, he looks at chapter 4, verse 28, regarding work. Here's Dr. Ken Boa.
A lot of you are wondering why I take so long to teach these books of the Bible in this study. I want you to know, I have a Monday night study that you're all invited to, and it meets across the street at the Kellett Chapel. And starting again this Monday night, what I do is a visual overview of the various books of the Bible, and I do each book in 1 hour. So it can be done. It can be done. And frankly, something you might enjoy doing. It's a bird's eye view that I do. Here, on the other hand, I'm in no hurry. Not only because the text is so rich, but because it evokes certain topics that it's worth our discussing. The last few weeks we've discussed in just a few verses the issue of laying aside falsehood. So we talked about the issue of truth. And then we spent last time talking about this issue of being angry. And so we've drilled down into the issue of anger. Truth and anger. And now I want us to focus on just a little word about Ephesians 4:28, which is yet another topic, because Paul, at this particular point in the epistle, is really drilling down and looking at a lot of different issues as he's trying to find the application of this life. This is highly relevant, and these are words of counsel whereby we apply eternal truth in a temporal arena. And it's very practical, timeless counsel, and it's worth our focusing on. So the verse for us to focus on this morning is Ephesians 4:28. And here it says, "He who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with one who has no need." Now that is a little sermon in itself, and I wanted to focus on this whole issue then of stealing, of work, of why do we go to work, and so forth, those kinds of issues. Now, some of you know that after I'm through with this series in Ephesians, I want to do a little short series on the issue of work. And a biblical view of work is something that, in my view, most people never hear. From what I'm able to tell in most churches and most situations we have, whether it's educational institutions, churches, whatever, most guys don't hear much about what the scriptures say about how they spend most of their time, which is rather odd to me. We hear a lot about the family, there's no question about that, and that's a huge part of our time, but not near as much about work. Now, that's been corrected a little bit in the recent years. As it turns out, about 25 years ago or so, there were, to my knowledge, only two or three ministries that focused on the marketplace. Just a handful of ministries that did that. Now there are literally hundreds of ministries that have cropped up in the last couple decades that focus on this important and overlooked issue of why go to work? How do we minister in the marketplace? How do we manifest eternal values in this temporal arena in which we find ourselves? How do we have a view of life that's not compartmentalized, but sees all things kind of connected together? And that's really the issues that these people wrestle with. And it's what I want us to focus on in our next series. But I wanted just to give you kind of a preview of that, just a few words about work. And about this first thought he has concerning theft, which is an interesting concept. As far as I can tell, it's transcultural and transtemporal. There is the moral laws of various societies all seem to be united on this particular issue. None of them regard stealing as a virtue. Whether it's Babylonian or Egyptian or Chinese or Assyrian or ancient or medieval or modern, the various codes around the world seem to be in agreement with this. And indeed, by the way, as C.S. Lewis rightly argued in his book, The Abolition of Man, which I strongly recommend for your reading, even though it was written, about 1940? It's still as relevant as it was when he, in fact, more relevant than it was when he wrote it. And there he deals with this whole issue of how we can lose a perspective on our lives, and we can embrace this wrong understanding and forget that there is a biblical worldview that relates to our education and to our thinking about the world. And there he talks about the Tao, T-A-O, but it's pronounced Tao. And he uses that particular word. He picks it up from Taoism, which is basically a Chinese religion, but he's not using it in that sense. What he's using it as is the literal meaning of a moral law, of a code, of something that is shared universally. And while it's true that there are variations in details, indeed, in certain societies, for example, cannibals regard it to be wrong not to clean your plate. I mean, so there are some things that gruesome, but no, the idea that there are some societies, yeah, there are variations, but a lot of people have tried to be skeptical and say that it's all up for grabs, and it's not. If you study all the codes, the law codes, all the way back to the law code of Hammurabi, the Old Testament law, and so forth, you find a remarkable convergence on the fundamental issues about truth-telling, about stealing, about lying, about the basic things that we see in the Ten Commandments, that there is a certain virtue to these things. And you do not want to compartmentalize your faith, but you want to relate it to all these issues. There was a man who sent the IRS a cashier's check in an unlabeled envelope. And in this envelope, there was a note that says, a little while back, I failed to report some income to you, and I'm having trouble sleeping. Here's a check for $500. If I still can't sleep, I'll send the rest. You know, it's sort of a mindset that people have. They get their... people can kind of let their convictions, after a while, worry you and so forth. But there is this measure, this issue, of where we try to understand, how should I live in this world on a day-by-day basis? We must never compartmentalize the faith, that everything matters and everything connects together. For example, with theft, he says, he who steals must steal no longer, but instead of that, he says, he must labor so that he'll actually, instead of stealing, he'll perform with his own hands what is good. There's the dignity of work I want to say a word about in a moment. So that, in addition to that, he will have something to share with people who have need. So rather than being someone who takes, he's someone who contributes, someone who gives, and someone who invests that which he's received from God into the lives of other people. This is part of the issue of work. Stealing takes many forms. There are lots of ways in which one can steal, not merely money, but we can steal time as well. There are a lot of people. I've had many jobs over the years. When I was in high school, in as an undergraduate, in graduate school at the seminary, Dallas Seminary, a lot of different jobs over the years. I counted 30 of them. A lot of different summer jobs, and sometimes I had two at once. That sort of a thing. Everything from being an assistant research scientist and also a clinical lab technician on the one hand, helping with autopsies and doing all the blood work and the urinalysis on one hand, to being a person who was working with a street crew with a gas company, with a jackhammer and the pick and shovel. A lot of different jobs over the years, and I've had to get to know a lot of different kinds of people. Jobs in factories, in fact, where there are some jobs that involve piecework. And if you're familiar with piecework, it's an interesting thing how unions have a way, in some cases, of changing the rules here. A new guy comes along and discovers that he can do four times as much work as the other guys are doing. Not because they can't do it, but because they have this idea that here's the standard. It took us a long while to lower the standard so that management expects this certain standard. You come in here, you're going to be in big trouble if you mess that up. you see, because we work 15 minutes and then we can play cards. This guy wasn't a card player, so he didn't catch on. But the point here is that I saw this happen a good deal. I also was in enough jobs to where I began to realize, how on earth could a person continue to do this on an ongoing basis? And I wrestled with that. How, if I were doing this on a full-time basis without realizing this is only a temporary job? Because you see, with these jobs, I could manage that pretty well because I felt that, in effect, I knew that they were just transitional things to provide for my income. For example, working at the Ford Motor Company on the assembly line. I had an interesting job there and lots of other crazy things that I did, but that one comes to mind. Each weekend I would work on Saturday and Sunday. And it was a good deal while it lasted. I got time and a half on Saturday and double time on Sunday, but it didn't work the rest of the week. Well, when the shop steward got hold of that, that was taken care of. But while it lasted, what would happen is I'd go in every Saturday. And what would happen would be that, as you know, the assembly line would never stop. And so I would have to learn my job, which is usually the same thing on this side of the car that the other guy on the other side of the car had to do. And I would be instructed as to how to do it, and I had certain operations. And it was fascinating to me how, you know, the learning curve was interesting because I'm trying to do all these things, I'm running out of time, the car is finally moving beyond me. I say, forget that, I'm going to the next one, you know. And this is where lemons were made, you see. They're Saturday morning cars by guys like me. And I wondered, because I can promise you there are certain things that were not equipped in these cars, and by my own testimony. The interesting thing, though, was by Saturday afternoon, by the end of the day, I was getting it down pretty well. And by Sunday, I was as good as the guy across from me. And then go wait around for the next time, like that. And I was very happy that every weekend I had a different job. So I had to learn, had the learning curve, it would have been too boring for me. I want to talk with you about how would you, if you had to do that every week, same job, how would you look at that kind of situation? How would you approach that if you knew this was a permanent situation? I'm not going to talk about that now. I'm going to talk about that when we discuss this issue of work. But there is a philosophy, a way of looking that can give dignity even to the apparently mundane that I think we need to bring to our work. But it's possible to steal time. We can do that a great deal. We can also steal ideas. It's called plagiarism. It's interesting, if you steal from one person, it's called plagiarism. If you steal from many, it's called research. But at any rate, we can steal people's ideas. We can take credit for their ideas, which is another form of theft. Or taking credit for their work, another form of theft. Not paying back debt we have incurred. All kinds of ways in which we can steal and violate the principles that the scriptures have given us about the way life ought to be led. And when we look at this, we need to recognize that God is one who has invited us to work with our hands, performing with our own hands what is good. And a quick word about this concept, that we must regard our work as something that God himself initiated. He's the one who started it, and work was really something designed in the image of God. It's something that he himself, as a worker, and work is really not a result of the fall. Rather, the nature of work was affected by the fall. The quality and the character of work was affected, but God himself was working. In 6 days he created the heavens and the earth. On the seventh, what did he do? There was a rhythm of work and leisure that one wants to look at. And that's why also when we speak about work, I want to have a few words about what's a biblical philosophy of leisure? Because people can miss and have a misunderstanding about what leisure is about. And in my view, leisure can be a mode of worship. And we can look at it that way, but that's another story. But as I see the scriptures, that it's patterned after God. God himself is a worker. Jesus says, I came to do the work that you sent me to do. I fulfilled that work. And we are called to have dignity in the work that we operate with and that we are called to do in our own lives and journeys. Clearly, the fall affected the character of the work and made it a context in which it could be one of exploitation, of manipulation, of all sorts of things that could happen. And so naturally, the character of work was truly distorted. Exploitation and oppression became characteristic in a fallen world. But nevertheless, the scriptures emphasize that we are not to be idle. The scripture rebukes idleness and sloth and affirms that work has genuine value. And that is a perspective that we need to see. That we actually can see that the way we work is a way in which we can serve God and serve other people. When I see this issue of work, when work is done in and for the Lord, it benefits other people if it's done in that way, and it honors God. There is nothing that's so apparently secular that it cannot be rendered spiritual. Remember how I've put this before a number of occasions? What appears to be secular becomes spiritual when the focus of your heart is the eternal. Remember that? We've said that. How many of you remember that? Is this the same group I've been talking to for years? I must have given that to you a dozen times. It's like a corporate Alzheimer's. You know, you meet all kinds of new people every day. You hear new jokes every day. You know, that sort of a thing. Learn new things every day, even though you heard it many times. That's never mind. The fact is that what we call secular, we need to be careful with this false dichotomy between the sacred and the secular, between the profane, as it's sometimes used, and the spiritual. Instead, the scriptures show that anything can be done to the glory of God, and therefore there is no secular dimension. A poem that I often like to quote by George Herbert is The Elixir. I'm not going to quote the whole thing for you, but just the first line, "Teach me, my God and King, in all things thee to see, and what I do in anything, to do it as for thee." Later on, it has another stanza when it says, "A servant with his claws makes drudgery divine, who sweeps a room as for thy laws, makes that and the action fine." Here he's taking the most mundane example he can think of sweeping a room. And he says, if you have this perspective that if you do it as unto the Lord, it actually honors him and serves other people, even when people don't notice, it can turn what we call drudgery into something that's divine. And ultimately, even when we sweep a room, who sweeps a room as for thy laws, for your honor, makes that, the action itself, it makes that and the action fine. The work itself becomes dignified, and the way in which we do the work is dignified. So that one of the things we want to see then is it's not only who we work for, but the way in which we do our work. It's not just the audience to whom we play, but the manner in which we do it. Do we do our work with skill and integrity and energy and focus? Do we do it in such a way that we honor those around us and seek to use our time and leverage that time well? Again, what appears to be secular, the most mundane work, factory work or whatever it might be, a lot of these jobs I've had, actually can become spiritual if the focus of your heart is the eternal. And that is what Herbert calls the elixir, that it's like the philosopher's stone that turns lead into gold. It can turn the lead of the ordinary into the gold of the extraordinary because it changes your perspective. And when you do it in that way, then the action becomes fine. In Chariots of Fire, which I'm going to be reteaching this fall in one of my Monday night sessions, I'm just adding 50 stills to it because I found I have a better way of teaching the movies now where there's no, after I teach a clip, instead of having a blank screen, I'm going to be using stills as I make my comments. It's just much more effective. So I'm going to reteach that. It's fresh in my mind having just gone through it again. And there's this great sermon. Eric, you can praise the Lord by peeling a spud if you peel it to perfection. That's the first line. You can praise the Lord by peeling a spud, a potato, if you peel it to perfection. Don't compromise. Compromise is the language of the devil. Run in God's name and let the world watch and wonder. Now, that's a great three-point sermon right there. The first point is that we can take what appears to be ordinary, even tedious work, but if we do it in a way that's pleasing to God and do it with excellence, then that becomes something that is a matter of worship. We don't want to compromise. That is to buy into a lie. We were never called to complacency or compromise, but to the dignity of pursuit of excellence. And if, in all things being equal, if I'm playing to an invisible audience, the quality of my work is likely to be a great deal greater than if I'm doing it to be a people pleaser. Because there's times when people aren't looking. But God sees what's behind the sheetrock. He sees what others do not see. And so if I'm seeking to be pleasing to Him, I will do it with integrity, even if others don't notice, because He does. And that is what it all comes down to. An old story about Michelangelo, whether it's true or not, I don't know. But he was asked why he was painting the top of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, which is over 30 feet high, if you've ever been there. Why are you painting it with such detail, with such care? Because it was very, very detailed. He says, no one down here is going to see that much detail. What was his response? You can probably guess it. He said, God will see. And the interesting irony is, photography has now given us all the detail. And so in books, I have a whole book just on the Sistine Chapel. You can see it in great detail. And his attention to detail has become a legacy to the world. He did it because he did it for God, not by way of eye service as a man pleaser. Even if people don't notice. And in my view, we are called then to do our work not to impress people, but to be pleasing to Christ. And when we do it that way, when we play to an audience of one instead of an audience of many, I think that will make an enormous difference in our incentive and in our integrity, because then our integrity, the congruence between our defined standard of behavior, which is our ethics, and our lived standard of behavior, which is our morality. Remember we've talked about that before, I think? Remember the difference between... This is fun. I can say anything and you haven't heard it before. Either I'm a rotten teacher or something. I'm not clear. Anything I say, it's new. This is good. I like to think of ethics. I define ethics as a defined standard of behavior. It's what you define morality to be. Whereas morality is our lived standard of behavior. It's how you actually live. And integrity is the degree of congruence between your ethics and your morality, between your defined standard and how you actually live. And nobody lives in this fallen world with perfect integrity, but the ideal would be for the two spheres to overlap more and more, so that the way we define our standards and the way we live them would actually become more and more congruent. And that way, even if whether people notice or not, it's being done with integrity and skill. Now, the interesting irony with that understanding is that it is therefore possible in some ways for the Godfather to actually have more integrity than many ministers. How is it possible for Don Vito Corleone to have more integrity than a minister? Here's how it's possible. He has a low defined standard, his ethics, and he's pretty consistent in his morality, his execution of it. The guy has integrity. That's a perverse form of integrity, but nevertheless, it's there. What he said, he meant. His yes was yes, and his no was no. And a lot of people, to their pain, discovered that. Nevertheless, it's possible for a person to be a minister or to be an educator or whatever, and for that person to fail in that level of integrity. In any sphere, we can do that. And so it's important for us to recognize that we have that overlap between one and the other. And that, I think, becomes more likely when we're doing it to an invisible audience, because we know that he sees. It's one of the things you want to do before you go to sleep. And I try to remember this. Sometimes I forget. But I try to remember before going to sleep to review the day and to analyze, to examine that day. The good parts, the bad parts, the things that I did wrong, thanking God for his forgiveness, but really having a brutally honest assessment of that day. So why? Why would one do that? Because you see, it's possible for a person to live the same year 40 years in a row. That experience by itself is not a teacher. If a person doesn't learn from their experience, they just do the same dumb things 40 years in a row. But if it's another person, though, learns from their experience, then each year they have greater skill in the art of living, so that we want to learn. That's why the examined life, that we want to live an examined life, and we ask the Spirit of God to enlighten us and illumine us so that we make those mid-course adjustments and recalibrate our spirits so that we are the next day in a better position to respond. And frankly, and I know this is true of me, and I'm pretty confident it's true of you, you learn an awful lot more from your mistakes than your successes. We learn a lot more from our failures than we do from the things that we did really well. I'm just sorry to say, but we, in a fallen world, it seems to be this way. Would it be prudent then for me to say, what went wrong? What was my role in that? How complicit was I? How could I approach that differently? Is there someone I need to approach for the issue of forgiveness because I overlooked something? Any number of things to really do an examination so that I can learn from those things. That's what work is also about. And so that we recognize that. I want to also stress that in our work, our identity transcends our work. You're not defined by your work if you're defined by the Word. If you bring your true definition of who you are in Christ to your sphere of work, then your identity transcends your work. You shape your work rather than it just defining and shaping you. It makes a difference there. And I believe that we are called then to serve God by serving other people, and God creates our work and gives us creative endeavor and activity whereby we can externalize the image of God in this world. I think it's really a very big mistake for a person simply to retire from life. And that's why I'm not a big believer in retirement, at least in the sense that some people define it, where they more or less retire from creative endeavor and activity. I think that all of us are called to kingdom work and kingdom ministry, and that your work is really part of your ministry. Unless you come to buy into the truth that your work is done for the glory of God, then you'll compartmentalize your life and see it only as this being spiritual, but this part I do, 9 to 5, that's secular. But instead, if I see that all I do is as unto him, and that it is all something that matters, then again, I will have greater integrity and a greater centrality in my own life and in my journey. So that I'm called then to see that work is a method or a mode of worship. That you worship God because you externalize the identity that God has given you in creative endeavor, and that you then create actual wealth. You create something that didn't exist before. You create value. You create value for your customers and your clients. And when you create that value, you're kind of a sub-creator under God, creating something worthwhile that can be shared with other people that you did not have before. So not only was it good for you because you had the opportunity to creatively externalize an identity, but it was also good for the people who will be in your life because you create work, you create jobs. And that's why The small business owner needs to be honored. And in my view, I think the best incentive program would have been clearly to make tax breaks for small businesses and make them in a position where they could create jobs. That's where, if you wanted to have a stimulus, it would have been stimulating small business. That's the fundamental issue, because in small business, what do? We create jobs. We create value. We create capital. We create things that are worthwhile. And yes, capitalism can be related to greed and it can be misused. I know that. But so can socialism. Last time I checked, greed was not just on one side. The fact that a good thing can be abused and distorted doesn't make it wrong. Having real value, which, by the way, I'm doing a book review in my great book series. We're changing it now, starting this month, and it's no longer going to be called the Great Book Series. We're broadening it, and we're going to be calling it Essential Readings. This is on breakpoint.org. You can subscribe. It's a monthly subscription. We're calling it Essential Readings, and we're calling it Classic and Contemporary Books for the Christian Mind. This opens up the field for me, so I can now include books like J.I. Packer's Knowing God, which I've just I've done, Timothy Keller's The Reason for God, Henri Nouwen's book I recently did, The Return of the Prodigal Sons, in that series. And right now I'm teaching on Gerald Stark's book, The Victory of Reason. And there he discusses how capitalism wasn't a matter of the Protestant Reformation. It wasn't just a matter of the spirit of Protestantism, as Max Weber said, but actually it preceded Protestantism by many years. It was something that was developed in the monastic orders, where they developed capital and had more wealth than they knew than they needed, and thus they began to use this, and it affected their societies as a whole. So it's an interesting thing. It has a much further history than that. Again, in my view, all things being equal, whether I look at the Old or the New Testament, a person who works as unto the Lord, using their energies, and by the way, all jobs have dignity. All honest professions are honorable. The biblical perspective never dichotomizes between something that is more honorable than another. There is dignity in blue-collar work as well as in white-collar work. It's not a question of one being stratified over the other. A person can have as much dignity in what others would look at as a minor position as the CEO. In fact, one of the tests that I sometimes use of myself is, how do I respond if I'm in a room of people and I discover one person is the CEO of this company, and then I meet somebody who happens to be a custodian? Do I treat them differently? You see this issue? And I promise you, I'm tempted to treat them differently. I suppose partly is because I suppose this guy has more to offer. Who can say? But we can buy into this world's shallow way of defining and differentiating, which I think is dangerous. This is why, in certain situations where I found myself, I actually try to make it an endeavor to seek out people who would ordinarily be overlooked. So watch it if I come to you. Gee, has it come to this that Bo is coming up to me? But I actually try to seek out those people, because I find that is actually, and not just seek them out, but learn from them. There's not a person you cannot learn from. When I take a cab, I ask the guy questions, because I can learn from that guy. There's insights he'll have that I don't have. So treating people with dignity, one of the things I loathe seeing when I go to restaurants is people who are in ministry who just shirk and ignore the people who serve them. I think that's a travesty. I think we ought to honor those people and give them dignity, find out their names and honor them in that way. You see what I'm saying? That everybody has honor and dignity before God. We might make this false stratification based upon the most shallow and superficial assessment of human nature. And I think that's a terrible blunder for us to make. Let me stop there for a minute and see if I've said something that needs to be clarified or any comments. Yes.
background.
It seems to me we live in a world of perception is reality.
Perception is reality, yeah.
Deception is a big part of creating the person.
Yes. I think a lot of this issue, in fact, it reminds me of the Andre Agassi commercial. What was that? Image is everything? Wasn't that the commercial? Image is everything. Does that not tell us what our culture is about? Image is everything. And frankly, we can know and predict with great certitude that people will buy into that lie. And the only way we can defeat lies is by countering it with truth. And so in my view, what I need to communicate there is that the dignity of all kinds of work, the dignity of those who are poor as well as those who have wealth, the dignity, whether it is any of the things that we use to stratify and to kind of categorize people, pigeonhole them, that everybody has the same dignity. Why? Because of the image of God. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Well, actually, that requires revelation. Unless you believe in God, there's no basis for that view. If I was an evolutionist, I would not have a robust basis for saying that all men are created equal. So what I'm saying is because we've been created in the imago Dei, we have this dignity. And so my job in raising a child or in working with people is to, or if I'm teaching a class of teenagers or whatever that thing is to help them think through in creative ways, how do we shape up and size up people? We could even use examples from media, from film, from advertisement, all kinds of stuff that we use to have this shallow mindset. American Idol. Those kinds of things astound me. You know, everyone wants. It was Andy Warhol who said that everybody ought to have 15 minutes of fame. It's a bizarre notion that, and there are people who'll do these crazy things, and they'll do things and be actually allowed themselves to be interviewed on television, and they'll show something that they wouldn't dare tell their dearest friends. But they can go on television and blather it to everybody. This is a bizarre thing. Somehow their perception of the people that are physically there and their perception of this other thing somehow is different. Perception is a huge issue. And how do you size someone up? And that really becomes the issue. And that's why I think it's good for us to examine our own hearts to see if we are really approaching people in a way that does not accord true dignity. My major point, if I had to pull one out of this session, is that work has inherent dignity when done for the name and done in a way that honors him, and that it is a means of glorifying God and therefore a mode of worship as much as what we do on Sunday morning. If I could truly believe that what I do on Monday morning can be as much a mode of worship as what I do on Sunday morning, then I'm beginning to make a paradigm shift which will affect me. Then I'll begin to realize, you know, actually I'm called to minister to serve my customers, my clients, my co-workers. I'm called to minister to them. And I may have a boss, or I may be someone else's boss, but I'm accountable because I have a master who's in heaven. And therefore, I must work in such a way that I recognize I'm accountable to that master. And to do it in such a way that it would be done in a way that's pleasing to him. And this is a great desire, the simplicity of that aspiration of being pleasing to him. Any other question or thought on that? Yes.
With respect to your comment earlier about doing everything unto the Lord, I've made the mistake of taking that notion of excellence in everything you do a little bit too far, past the point of diminishing returns, where you do end up stealing time and resources in kind of a perfectionism.
Yeah, that's a very good word. Because it's one thing to do something with excellence. It's another thing to become so perfectionistic that it begins to be counterproductive. This becomes especially true if you have a touch of OCD, as I do. I have enough of that I have to watch myself because I can drill down so much that I lose productivity. And that's why it's important for me to back off and assess What's the cutoff point where I have to just let it go? And that's the hard part, is to let it go. Because we're not in a perfect world, but you know what we're trying to do? It's sort of a control freak mindset that I have, where I want it to be so tidy and so organized that I have the illusion of control.
Doesn't that come down to assessing the job in the first place? So if you're sweeping the floor, it's not just getting it clean, but it's getting it clean in that time allotted.
That's correct. What you're dealing with then is it's job-specific, person-specific. It's specific to that, to the parameters. So that, for example, if I'm called to, going back to my days on the street crew, if I, after digging that hole, now I have to put the dirt back in the hole, if I felt I had to take every grain of dirt and make sure it goes in the hole, you know, I'm down there with a toothbrush, you know, there comes a point where you're overdoing it. There comes a point where it becomes counterproductive. So I want to do it well, but I also, and this is a hard part, I don't want to be a control freak. I need to let loose, and it's called optimization, where I optimize the parameters. And frankly, we live in a world where you've got to compromise. I don't mean that you, when compromising your integrity, but there are certain trade-offs that need to be made so that you have the optimal combination insofar as it is possible. There is no simple word either as to how long should I stay in this job, or how do I take that job, or whatever, if I'm not being given, if I'm beginning to be oppressed because of my own specific spiritual commitments, or any number of things. There's no simple formula. Wisdom requires that we do the right thing at the right time for the right reason and in the right way. And that means that there's no simple formula. That's why wisdom means that we have to see things in a specific manner, in a situation-specific manner, pray and ask God for wisdom as to how much is enough, where do we go from there, and then to kind of reevaluate and recalibrate. So I suffer with that malady myself. Yeah, I really do, yes.
A shrink friend of mine about 5 years ago said that a selective perfectionist is the surgeon that you want operating on. But a general perfectionist needs to be institutionalized.
That's rather good. Did you all hear that? That's rather good. A selective perfectionist is someone like a surgeon. You want to be a perfectionist.
Ken, one of the other things that in Genesis when God said, work the garden,
very quick word on that. When he called them to work and to rule, actually the word that's used there is cognate to the word for worship. It's an interesting thought that he is part of the rule over the world. And stewardship, a biblical view of stewardship, involves this, ecology, by the way, involves three major thoughts from the Genesis 1 and 2 account. First, we've been given dominion, authority. Secondly, we are stewards of that dominion, and we are therefore accountable. And third, we are called to be fruit-bearing, fecundity. That is to say that what we do actually bears fruit. And that is, in my view, a very good way of looking at the resources of this world.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.